Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more? Check out my podcast. Hi, I'm Kadra, the host of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. I tell tales every single week that have left me perplexed. You'll hear true crime cases, mysterious disappearances, learn about cults, hear baffling sightings of cryptids, chilling paranormal encounters, and even dark and weird history. I release new episodes every Wednesday, and you can listen anywhere podcasts are available. I'm also on Patreon, and you can even watch me on YouTube. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. Stories that will leave you perplexed.
Hey there, fellow true crime aficionados. We're the host of Bad Acts, a true crime podcast. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Aaron.
Join us every Thursday for twisted true crime tales of dark deeds and despicable people. We focus on lesser known unique stories with a new case each week. We've covered family annihilators, cannibals, revenge killings, killer kids, mysterious murders, survivor stories, and much more. We've even tackled stories of people who blamed zombies, vampires, ghosts, and voodoo for their bad acts.
Of course, we know they're the only ones to blame. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts, or you can visit our website at badactspod.com.
If you like fresh stories and new perspectives on crime, Bad Acts will be your new jam. Join Bad Acts every Thursday. Stay safe, y'all.
See you soon.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy.
Yeah, it's always good to hang out with you guys.
What story do you have for us today, Declan?
I'm going to be talking about Nicole Brown Simpson.
Oh, big one.
Yes. I'm sure people might not. I wasn't entirely familiar with it when I looked it up, but everyone knows the famous clips from that whole situation.
Yes.
That I'll be talking about today. But what story do you have for us today?
Cool. Well, I have a Christmas story. Because this episode, if you're listening to it on the day that it comes out, is coming out on Christmas Eve. And I had to go with the calendar to tell me what kind of story to tell. So I'm doing a Christmas story.
Merry Christmas to all that celebrate. Happy holidays to all that don't.
And happy December whatever day you're listening to, or potentially January, or whatever. Happy day that you're listening to this.
Happy day story. To you.
Yes. Okay. To go with my story, I brought the gingerbread old-fashioned. You know I love an old-fashioned.
And I know you love a holiday-themed cocktail.
Yes, I do. It's so great. So a gingerbread old fashioned. You can make the gingerbread syrup yourself or you can buy it. I made it because I wanted to see if I could make a good syrup. We'll see. But it's 2 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce of gingerbread syrup, 2 to 3 dashes of bitters. I used orange bitters because I thought that would be tasty. And if you want to, you can garnish it with a gingerbread cookie. I don't have a gingerbread cookie, so I did not do that.
You shouldn't garnish with a gingerbread cookie. Don't dip cookie in your old fashioned.
Oh, that would be nasty. Flavor. No, yeah, no, don't. You don't dip a don't cookie do in your old fashioned.
A gingerbread cookie I feel like the texture of it, if it got wet, it would crumble into the drink. Wouldn't be like an Oreo where it soaks it up. I think it would like, it would turn into like wet, like wet drywall.
Sand. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
The directions are to place a large ice cube into an old-fashioned glass and stir it to help the glass get cold, or just leave your glass in the fridge or the freezer if you like. Pour in 2 ounces of bourbon or rye, 1/2 ounce of your gingerbread syrup or more if you're like me, like it's sweeter, and then 2 to 3 dashes of aromatic bitters into a mixing glass. Add ice and stir gently with a bar spoon for about 15 to 20 seconds to ensure all ingredients are well combined and chilled. After stirring, strain the drink into your prepared glass over the large ice cube. Twist an orange peel over the surface to release its oil, then drop into the glass. Add a cinnamon stick. And if you want to, like I said, use a gingerbread cookie to garnish it. Maybe don't dip it in, but you could stand it up on the edge of the glass or just skip it. Are you ready for this? I'm kind of nervous because the syrup is going to be strong on those spices, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It's actually really good.
It's not bad. Yeah.
I like it. I like it.
Very light on the syrup, so because I was scared of it.
Yes.
But it's not bad.
I like it. It's tasty. I have an idea someone else that we know will also like it.
Gina?
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll see. I'll report back.
Okay.
Okay, let's get into my story. This is about Rudy Whitlock. He worked for a shipping company known as Northern Logistics, and it's located in Alaska. The winter months at the company is always a very busy time of the year. This company was responsible for routing and transporting thousands of packages across the region. Their employees were typically a close-knit group, but not always. Rudy was a recent hire and stood out from the pack. In general, people commented that he seemed quiet and polite. He was appreciated for being efficient at his job, but those qualities didn't endear him to his coworkers. Rudy had a little quirk that some found rather annoying, and the other employees made fun of him for it. He had a condition called hyperacusis, which just meant he had really good hearing, especially for high-pitched sounds. In a shipping facility, it could be both helpful and annoying. At least it was annoying to his coworkers. What it meant at a job like his was he could hear if equipment was malfunctioning. When Rudy heard mechanical sounds that was unusual, he physically reacted by flinching. Let me finish my story before you ask questions.
Is this a form of synesthesia? Is he like a mechanic synesthesia? He can hear.
No, because he hears the sounds. He just hears them before other people do. Like, he has really good hearing, like a dog.
So he can't hear like a little thing is like, oh, the belt tensioner needs to be tightened a quarter of an inch or something like that.
Well, he can hear it before people.
Okay.
He can hear the malfunction before it happens. Because he has really good hearing. You know, like your dad has really bad hearing and I have better hearing, although mine's not. Mine's better than him.
All of our hearing sucks. Wish we're not a good pretty hearing much. Family.
Yeah. When Rudy heard mechanical sounds that were unusual, he physically reacted by flinching. It looked strange to anyone who didn't know what was happening, and his coworkers began teasing him. Rudy typically ignored the comments and just did his job. But the more he reacted to the machines, the more the jokes escalated. Soon, whole groups joined in making fun of him and bullying him. Rudy often wondered how long the teasing would last and what he could do to stop it. Things came to a head one winter night. What?
That's how you stop teasing. Make fun of him back and be better at it than them.
Right. So. You have to be better at it. That's the that's the hard part is you got to be better at it than them. I don't think fast enough on my feet to be fast or better at it than somebody. I just take the ridicule.
I can only do it with people I know. People I know I can fight back on pretty quick. But.
True. So one winter night, there was a winter storm that could delay outgoing trucks and push delivery deadlines into dangerous territory if they could get everything done on time. If they couldn't, they were going to be in trouble. The warehouse ran at maximum capacity to catch up. Machines that normally got breaks were now running nonstop. Nearly 2 a.m., Rudy froze in place. A thin, high-pitched whine sliced through the warehouse noise, but it was the kind of sound that no one else could hear. That frequency only happened when a major conveyor motor was seconds away from seizing. He went to the supervisor's platform where Nick Roman, the shift lead, monitored operations.
This would bug the absolute fucking shit out of me.
Yes, it would.
I hate when, because I work right next to, like, my desk is right next to the maintenance man's room. And sometimes he has to, like, use a saw or something. And it, like, it completely disrupts everything I'm doing when he's working.
Yeah.
I have to answer phones a lot. And I can't, back to the hearing thing, with two noises coming from different ears.
Too much.
Messes with my brain waves or something.
Yes. Yes. He told Nick what he heard and urged him to look into a specific machine. Nick barely looked up and explained they couldn't afford to take any machines offline to look at them. Nick wasn't concerned because the machine in question had just been serviced earlier in the week. Rudy took the situation under control and grabbed a can of lubricant spray. Just as he approached the machine in question, the mechanical system of the belt started to slow and screech loudly. This finally got Nick's attention, as well as the rest of the workers. Rudy sprayed the inner wheels just as the conveyor belt began to seize. His quick thinking got the machine running smoothly again and prevented the logistics team from losing control of the night. Turns out, Rudy and his special talent saved the day.
I think the special talent might just be autism. What was that episode we did about the lady that was interviewing all the autistic kids and finding out they had like superpowers? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got machine telepathy. He knows.
Right. Yes. Okay. I didn't want you to ask questions because I didn't want you to ruin the story because it is all make-believe. It is based on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
What?
It's all made up. But I do have other. I couldn't make Rudy as Rudolph and all the coworkers are making fun of him. And the supervisor's name was Nick. God. I couldn't make him have a weird nose. Okay. I know. It's terrible.
I don't know what to say.
I know. Okay. Silly stories aside, on a previous episode, you mentioned wanting to cover urban myths.
Yes.
For this time of year, I thought it would be cool to do a story about the Christmas mythology and the evolution and the background of it. That's what my real story is about.
Okay.
It's about how Santa got to be Santa. And where the reindeer came from.
Ooh, interesting.
So it's kind of it.
Are we getting into Joe Rogan territories with
no
magic mushrooms?
Not at all.
Okay, not that deep.
No, it all goes down to like our current stuff all comes from marketing. But we'll get to that.
I won't get too deep, but I think I know what company's behind it.
Okay, we'll see. It's more than one company.
Okay.
Specifically, the evolution of Santa Claus. Long before the familiar red-suited Santa Claus soared across the skies, the roots of his story can be traced back to the historical figure of Saint Nicholas. Saint Nicholas was a 4th-century Christian bishop who was known for his generosity towards children and the poor, and he became a beloved saint as a result of it. Wait, over the centuries, his legend...
I think it was last year I talked about it, but the tomb of Saint Nicholas was found in Turkey last year.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Just thought I'd throw that in there because I think I talked about it very briefly last year. But yes, maybe. They found the sarcophagus of Saint Nicholas in Turkey.
Are they sure it was
Turkey.
Saint Nicholas? Like, how do they know that? How do they know who it belonged to? Did it have his name on it?
It was built during the Byzantine Empire, and a body was found in the walls of the Church of St. Nicholas. So I believe that's why they're thinking it's St. Nicholas. Okay. But
could be.
I don't know a lot about religious history. That's
neither do I.
Too much for me to know.
He started off as a Christian bishop. I don't know exactly where, but somewhere in Europe. But then eventually the Dutch renamed St. Nicholas to Sinterklaas. And they brought the Sinterklaas tale with them when they immigrated to what is now known as New York. The name eventually morphed into the commonly known name Santa Claus. The most recognizable aspect of the modern Santa legend, a snowy Christmas Eve visit, flying reindeer, a sleigh, chimney entry, gift giving to children, that began to emerge in the early 19th century with a couple of poems. In 1821, a small New York booklet titled A New Year's Present to the Little Ones from 5 to 12 was published. That is too long of a name, in my opinion. Inside was an anonymous illustrated poem called Old Santa Claus with Much Delight. This is the first known printed work to describe Santa Claus, which was one word. I don't know where they got this stuff. Anyway, that described him traveling by a sleigh pulled by a reindeer. Just a single reindeer, though.
Santa Claus, is that German? Is that where you said this?
No, Sinterklaas was
Sinterklaas
what
sounds like a German word.
It does. It was Dutch.
Sinterklaas. Oh, close enough. Nah.
Probably.
Neighborhood.
Yeah. The story described him delivering gifts on Christmas Eve, and the accompanying illustrations are also the earliest known published images of a Santa-like figure. In that version, Santa's mode of transport was a sled and a single reindeer. The poem also described him soaring over chimney tops in his sleigh. 2 years later, another poem titled A Visit from St. Nicholas was published anonymously in the Troy Sentinel. This poem is now more widely known by its opening line, "'Twas the night before Christmas," which, as a kid, I read every Christmas Eve without fail.
'Twas the night before Christmas and all through the house.
All through the house.
Is that the?
Yes.
Is that the? Yep. Okay.
That was it. It introduced many features now essential to the Santa legend, including the sleigh being pulled by 8 reindeer. The poems introduced the conceptual elements of Santa: sleigh, reindeer, chimney visits, and gifts. Illustrators and pop culture helped standardize Santa's image into what we know now, the jolly old elf, chubby, red cheeks.
Logistically, Christmas is a fucking nightmare. I work in shipping, trying to figure out how to get Christmas presents to every person that celebrates Christmas.
Yeah.
All going down their chimneys, one man on a sleigh. There'd have to be multiple Santas. And
100%.
That's proven by how many mall Santas there are. I bet you there's a million Santas, but they all look the same. So they're
those are the subcontractors.
It's like a mail person. They all wear the same uniform, and they each have their route. So Santa, the mall Santas, turn into the real Santas and drive the sleighs to their mail routes and pop down the chimneys. I figured it out. Okay, I know how Santa does it.
You did.
Okay.
In the mid 19th century. In the mid-19th century, cartoonist Thomas Nast created illustrations for Harper's Weekly that greatly shaped the familiar Santa. Bearded, portly, warmly dressed. Well, of course he's warmly dressed. Like, what's he going to be wearing? He was often depicted with a sleigh, reindeer, a bag of toys, and even a home at the North Pole. That was mid-19th century. Christmas itself was transformed to modern consumer culture and the growth of mass media, and was less focused on previous religious traditions. As the image of Santa changed, so did the concept of his sleigh and reindeer. It started as one reindeer pulling the sleigh and morphed into eight flying reindeer, which held for about 100 years. Rudolph and his glowing red nose was introduced to the team in 1939, which rounded out the modern Christmas mythology that has endured to current times.
Hmm.
And that, it's interesting to me that 1939 was the last major change to Santa Claus and his mythology. And it's been almost 100 years and we have the same basic concept of Santa. It hasn't changed much in the last couple hundred years.
What I thought you were going to say is that Coca-Cola was largely behind it. Because I had heard somewhere, but I just looked it up.
It was not Coca-Cola.
Google AI overview. But Coca-Cola's involvement in Christmas is massive, primarily through shaping the modern image of Santa Claus with Haddon Sonblum's warm, jolly depiction from 1931 to 1964, establishing him as a universal rosy cheek figure with red and white attire, the Coca-Cola colors.
Right.
The addition of their Christmas caravan ads, which included polar bears, cementing the brand with festive cheer, making Coke a year-round winter drink because they were struggling to sell their refreshing beverage in the wintertime.
Well, I mean, I get it. You want to drink warm stuff when it's cold outside.
Yeah,
I thought
maybe.
I had... It's not...
Coca-Cola's.
So the current rendition of Santa came from those anonymous poems, but the... Mm-hmm. The addition of Rudolph was from an advertisement. I want to say it was Montgomery Ward, but I could be making that up because I can't remember now. I'm trying to find my... I thought I put it in here, but I didn't. I cut it because I was like, I don't care. Let me see.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at that. The drawing of Santa Claus. He looks like he's wearing a ghillie suit in this. I think it's a newspaper.
That's funny.
Or something. But he's wearing like, it's a typical Santa shape man with a big white beard, but he's wearing like a weird ghillie suit and has a big knapsack on his back.
That is weird. It was a 1939 Montgomery Ward booklet that included our friend Rudolph.
Oh, this is... Oh, the picture I'm looking at is... It was made in 1885 and was an advertisement from Ivory Soap. And it showed him delivering Ivory Soap in a stocking. That's interesting.
That's a shitty stocking gift. No, thank you.
Yeah. Back in the day, it was probably nice, but let us know if you'd be interested in a history of Coca-Cola, because there's a lot of strange history about Coca-Cola. Like, they had entire wars in, I think it was South America, to get the products to make Coca-Cola.
Oh, really?
They had such big influence in a lot of marketing campaigns. Like, Coca-Cola has had a very interesting history. Like, they used to be made with cocaine.
Could you imagine? I can't even imagine.
Cocaine soda? I don't need I don't need a Red Bull. I need an old-fashioned Coke.
Right. I just need a cocaine soda.
Yeah. Let us know if you'd be interested in hearing some of the history of Coca-Cola, because I think they have a very checkered past. It'd make for a good bizarre episode. But
yeah.
Let's talk about Nicole Brown Simpson. So, on the night of June 12th, 1994, in one of the wealthiest and most tightly controlled neighborhoods of Los Angeles, a brutal double homicide shattered the illusion that money, fame, and celebrity could insulate anyone from violence. The victims were Nicole Brown Simpson, a 35-year-old mother of two, and Ronald Goldman, a 25-year-old restaurant waiter who happened to be in the wrong place at the worst possible fucking time.
No kidding.
Yeah. So within days, suspicion focused on one man, Ornenthal James Simpson, also known as OJ, known as the Juice. He's a former NFL superstar, actor, and Nicole's ex-husband. What followed was not only one of the most infamous murder investigations in American history, but a trial that exposed deep divisions in race, class, domestic violence, awareness, policing, and the power of being a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Nicole Brown was born on May 19th, 1959, in Frankfurt, West Germany. Her father, Louis Brown, was a journalist for Stars and Stripes, and her mother, Juditha Brown. That's an interesting name. I like that name. Juditha Brown raised Nicole and her three sisters in a disciplined but loving household. The family later relocated to Dana Point, California, where Nicole spent most of her adolescence. Friends described her as a warm, soft-spoken, and eager-to-please person. She was athletic, attractive, and socially popular, but also somewhat shy. Nicole graduated from Dana Hills High School in 1977 and later enrolled in El Camino College, though she never completed a degree. At just 18 years old, her life would change forever after meeting one of the most famous athletes in America. OJ was born born July 9th, 1947 in San Francisco, rose from a troubled childhood to national stardom. By the late 1970s, he was one of the most recognizable figures in the country, an NFL Hall of Fame running back, Heisman Trophy winner, and later a Hollywood pitchman and actor. Which, I didn't really know he was an actor.
Yeah.
But
Not in a bunch of stuff and not a great actor, but
he was in Naked Gun. It looks like all the Naked Guns. No Place to Hide. Student Exchange, Back to Beach, Cocaine, and I've only heard of Naked Gun. None of these other movies.
Same.
Yeah, he's got a lot of movies that you would probably struggle to find a way to watch them now.
Probably.
Anyways, by the time he met Nicole Simpson, Nicole Brown at this point, he was already married and the father of three children. He was 30 years old, and Nicole was 18, which is problematic.
That's a big age gap.
Probably one of the least problematic things he did in their relationship.
Yes, true.
They met in 1977 at the Daisy, a Beverly Hills private club where Nicole worked as a waitress. Simpson began pursuing her aggressively. Their age gap, power imbalance, and his celebrity status shaped the dynamic from the very beginning. Simpson divorced his first wife, Marguerite Whitley, in 1979, and he married Nicole Brown on February 1985. Together, they had two children, Sydney and Justin. From the outside, they appeared glamorous and privileged, but behind closed doors, their marriage was violent. Throughout their relationship, Nicole endured years of physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. And I just want to say, like, CTE has been proven to increase all of these things that I just said happening.
Right.
And they didn't really know about CTE back then. Like, it was just, oh, you have a concussion and then it goes away. But, it's one of those weird diseases that you can't really diagnose until someone dies.
Until they die, yeah.
So police records show at least 8 documented domestic violence incidents between 1989 and 1994. These included bruising and visible injuries, Nicole calling 911 in fear for her life, OJ breaking down doors, verbal threats, and stalking behaviors. In 1989 incident, Nicole told police, "He's going to kill me." Photographs taken by responding officers show her face battered and bruised. Despite this history, Simpson was never meaningfully punished. He received minimal fines, short counseling requirements, and continued access to Nicole. They divorced in 1992, but Simpson refused to let go. Friends later described him as obsessively controlling, monitoring her movements, showing up to places that she was at uninvited, and reacting violently to perceived rejections. In the weeks before her death, Nicole had grown increasingly afraid of OJ. She confided in her friends that he was stalking her. She changed her phone number. She avoided being alone when possible and even changed the locks to her house. On June 12, 1994, Nicole attended her daughter Sydney's dance recital at Paul Revere Middle School. OJ was present, but witnesses later described him as visibly angry and cold towards Nicole. After the recital, Nicole hosted a family dinner at her home on Bundy Drive. OJ was invited, but left abruptly after becoming irritated over a disagreement involving their children. That evening, Nicole planned a quiet night at home, but she never made it to bed. Nicole returns to her Bundy Drive home after dinner around nine at night to 10 at night. I mean, the times are a little wishy-washy, but she changed into a black dress and sandals and goes into her home. Ron Goldman finishes his shift at Mezzaluna Trattoria in Brentwood. A waitress asked him to return a pair of glasses left behind by Nicole's mother earlier that evening. And Goldman agrees. At around 10:15 to 10:20, Ron Goldman arrives at Nicole's condominium. Evidence suggests he encountered the killer either upon arrival or moments after. Nicole was attacked first. She is stabbed repeatedly and nearly decapitated. The wounds indicate a deep slashing motion to the throat consistent with a large sharp knife. Defensive wounds are present on her hands, indicating she attempted to protect herself. Ron Goldman is then attacked. He fights back fiercely. His body shows multiple stab wounds and signs of prolonged struggle. He is stabbed repeatedly in the chest, abdomen, and neck. Both victims die within minutes. Shortly after midnight, on June 13th, a neighbor walking his dog notices blood outside Nicole's gate. Police respond and discover the bodies. Nicole is found face down near the front entrance. Ron Goldman lies nearby, his hands bruised and his both their clothing soaked in blood. I can't imagine. That's another reason not to have a dog. Lots of people who walk their dogs find dead bodies and stuff like that. And if you just had a cat, you could stay inside. Dead bodies you're going to find are from your own doing. So you won't be surprised.
That's true.
Or your cat's doing. That's true. Cats are a little psychotic like that, but.
Yep. That is a valid point.
Detectives immediately note Simpson's violent history with Nicole. They travel to his Rockingham estate where they discover a matching glove, blood stains in Simpson's Ford Bronco. cuts on Simpson's left hand, and blood drops leading into his home. Pretty damning evidence, if you ask me, but
yes.
DNA tests later link Simpson's blood to the crime scene and the victim's blood to Simpson's car and residence. The statistical probability of his DNA mixture belonging to anyone else is astronomically low. Despite this, the investigation is plagued by missteps, evidence mishandling, lack of proper containment, accusations of police racism, particularly involving Detective Mark Furman. These flaws would later become central in Simpson's defense. On June 17, 1994, O.J. Simpson is scheduled to surrender to police. Instead, he flees, and we get a very famous video from it.
Yes, the white Bronco.
Which, inadvertently, I bet you that increased the sales of white Broncos through the
probably
fucking roof.
Probably.
So what follows is a surreal, naturally televised, slow-speed chase. You hear a lot of high-speed chase stories, but this was not a high-speed chase. It looked like...
Nope.
It looked like he was the president, and they were just, like, escorting him through town. It was crazy.
Yeah, it's wild.
So Simpson rides in the back of a white Ford Bronco driven by his friend Al Crawlings. Police later find a gun, a disguise, cash, and a suicide note in the vehicle, which I didn't know about.
Oh.
After nearly 2 hours, Simpson returns home and is arrested without incident. So they were just...
They're just following him
around L.A. for 2 hours. And then they're like, well, I guess it's time to go home and get arrested.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I wonder what kind of conversations were happening in that car during that drive.
Oh, dude, he probably confessed everything. Owl Crawlings needs to write a book. OJ wrote a book.
Yeah.
Owl Crawlings needs to write, like, the back of...
For sure.
Oh, I already know the title. The Back of the Bronco. Because he was the sitting in the back.
Yep.
An estimated 95 million Americans watched the chase live.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Well, it took That's a like long a time because it was slow speed. They're just like, what is
it?
I mean,
it was two hours long. The chopper probably had to land and refuel while they were
probably the chopper was probably having to trade out with others to fly that slow.
Just okay, ridiculous. So the criminal trial of the People versus O.J. Simpson begins in January 1995. Prosecution presents extensive physical evidence, including DNA, blood, fibers, gloves, motive, rooted in the many, many counts of domestic violence he had against her.
Right.
The defense counter with the claim of police corruption, evidence planting, and racial bias. Mark Furman's credibility collapses after recordings reveal racist language. The jury, sequestered for nearly 9 months, becomes isolated from public pressure, but acutely aware of the trial's racial implications. 9 months of a fucking trial?
9 months of sequestered service. Yeah.
You better have a good job that will let you take that 9 months off. Like, if you just... If you just happen to be called for trial and you work at like 7-Eleven, there's no way they're letting you get your paycheck for 9 months. Like you're
fucked.
That's fucked. Yeah. That shouldn't.
Wow.
I understand trials take a long time, but there should be an extent. Like if it takes that fucking long, like you're not only potentially taking the rights away from a person that could be potentially innocent, but you're also taking the jurors' time. They don't want to be sitting there all fucking day. Like, it just blows my mind. Like, there's a rapper that I used to listen to I think he's been on trial for like 5 years now. Because they had a mistrial at the first one. And then they retried him. And it's just as much of a shit show as the first one. And it's like...
The first one.
At some point, you need to let... If you can't fucking prove it that much, just
call it a day.
Yeah, call it a fucking day.
Yep.
But anyways, on October 3rd, 1995, the verdict is read. O.J. Simpson was found not guilty on both counts of murder. Courtroom erupts across America reactions were split sharply. Because one of the big parts of that trial, I'm sure everyone's also seen that clip, is
the glove.
If the glove does not fit, you must acquit. Is that what the what the lawyer said?
Something along those lines.
And he just like balled up his fingers and tried to put the glove on.
It's like, yeah.
I could make a glove not fucking fit. That's not that
right.
Hard, but especially if you have big hands like that, it's easy to fumble with a glove. But
yeah.
In 1997, a civil court filed against O.J. Simpson found him liable for wrongful death of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and he was ordered to pay $33.5 million in damages to their families.
Wow, that is Nicole's
family. Nicole's family used the money to establish the Nicole Brown Foundation to raise awareness about domestic violence. O.J. Simpson later served prison time for unrelated crimes, but never faced criminal accountability for Nicole's murder.
Nope.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Anyways, O.J. went on to make a book called If I Did It or something like
if
that.
If I Did It. That's the fuck.
It's fucking. I mean, he can't be tried if he was already acquitted. He can't be tried again.
I know.
But goddamn.
It amazes me the fucking balls to do that, to write a book. Okay.
You know.
He doesn't.
Oh, I wonder if there's like any measurement of how much money he made from it.
He doesn't give a fuck about her family, Goldman's family, none of that. I get it. What about his kids with Nicole? He should at least care enough about them.
They had two kids
to
together.
Not
like
be a that is the lowest worms are above that in the evolutionary chain. I mean, come on.
Yeah. So it looks like that the book was canceled after initially being released, and only about 400,000 copies. Oh, wait,
oh,
no.
Oh, really?
400,000 copies were destroyed.
Oh. Whoa.
So they then later re-released it, and all the rights were later awarded to the Goldman family in the settlement, which was the $33.5 million. So he potentially collected that much money from selling that book, which is...
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, I get it. If you don't care about anybody, you should at least care enough about your kids to not do.
I didn't realize they had kids
together.
He
got away with it.
I just knew the basics of the story until I looked it up. But yeah.
If he got away with it, then just go on with your life, be a smug prick, and be like, I got away with murder. Ha ha ha. But then to write that book that you know your kids are going to have some exposure to, that's just a slap in the face to the kids.
If you look at the cover of the book, have you seen the cover of the book?
No, but now I'm going to go Google it.
So it's an all black background with red text that says, I did it. But in the center of the I, it says very small if.
Oh, if.
So it's basically the book of... If you're walking through an aisle, it says,
yes,
I did it. The Confessions
100%.
Of a Killer. God.
That's awful. Yeah.
Fucking
that's
horrible.
Just awful.
Thankfully, he's dead.
Now. I need to. I need a chaser.
Yes.
What chaser do you have?
My chaser is another, I'm sure you're going to love this, another non-comedy Kevin James movie that just came out.
Oh, okay. There's more than one.
It's called Guns Up. So Kevin James plays a henchman for the mob and on the brink of leaving his family, meaning the mob, they put like a hit out on him, and he has to get his family out of town before the mob comes after him.
Oh, interesting.
Pretty interesting. I like Kevin James as a non-comedic actor. I know what you're saying. Like, I'm just waiting for him to break out in his, like, the moves he did in, like, Zookeeper or, like, something like that. But
something.
I mean, if you think about, he did, what was that UFC movie that he did with Boss Rutten, where he's a teacher? He's a teacher and he has to save the band program and he decides to UFC fight. But that one's got a serious undertone, but it is a comedy movie.
It's still comedy.
I think
we watched that whole Becky movie with him in it. I kept waiting for him to crack a joke, even a little bit. And he was so serious.
It made it a comedy movie because you would never expect Kevin James to have neo-Nazi tattoos all over him and be a fucking Nazi. So that inherently made the movie funny because it's
I couldn't get over it. It was so bizarre.
It is a little. It's like watching. Well, still Adam Sandler. I like him in his serious roles too. You didn't like the Gemstone movie, but...
I did not.
Did you watch the basketball one that he did?
I don't think so.
Like a year or two after that? It's a really good movie. I think Dad watched it while you were asleep because it's like a sports movie. But he's like a basketball coach.
I like sports movies.
You'd probably like it then. It's he's a basketball coach and he finds this dude in Spain who's like a construction worker, but he's really good at basketball and he... helps get him into the league and stuff. It's like a heartwarming sports movie, kind of like Blindside, I guess, and the way it makes you feel. But like, it's I think those comedic actors. I think it'd be really hard for me to see David Spade as a serious actor,
right?
I think I would struggle. But Kevin James looks so different than he did in his comedy movies. Now that he's bald and has a big beard, he looks like a different guy. So I can kind of separate them in my brain.
I still can't. I'm going to have to see a lot of him in that role.
Kevin James now looks like the guy from Terminal List, the who also plays the translator in The Covenant. It's a bald guy with a beard. He's in both Terminal Lists and I can't remember his fucking name, but he looks just like Kevin James, but a different race.
I can't think of who it is.
Okay. What's your chaser? Enough
about mine. My chaser is going back to the fact that this is coming out on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
It is. I had never heard of this before, but it's called The Big Give. So in the UK, there's a charity fundraising thing. It's called The Big Give. It's a UK-based charity fundraising platform that runs an annual Christmas challenge where donations are matched pound for pound, doubling their impact. So if you donate a dollar, they're going to match that at $1.
Christmas 401k?
For charities. During the campaign, money pledged in advance by major donors matches public gifts, so charities receive twice the funding from their donation. They did it this year, and it was their biggest year so far. They've been doing this for a while, and I have to go get the numbers because I screenshotted it, but then for some reason it disappeared. This year, 2025, they raised £57.4 million.
Wow.
In this. Yeah. And that translates to around $76 million US dollars that they raised during this one Christmas charity campaign.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. It's amazing.
is pretty freaking cool. I've
been really obsessed with watching Angel Tree videos on Reels and Shorts. Do you know what those are?
I don't know.
They're like little trees that certain stores, I think like Walmart and Target and stuff like that, they go to like and they'll put up like a card and it's like, hey, my name's Bryce, I'm 10 years old and I want this Lego set and some new shoes. And I've been obsessed with watching like Instagram people like that have money. They're like, I'm going to go grab 6 Angel Tree cards and just buy, like, they'll fill up 2 carts just full of toys and stuff and donate
them.
That's
awesome.
I love watching. Yeah. That's when I get high at night, I watch those types of videos. Like, people, like, or like going up to homeless people and be like, oh, here's a free haircut and a night to stay and here's a job interview and just things like that.
Make
my heart feel
That's really cool.
Whole.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Well,
I like it.
That's the end of today's episode. Thanks for joining us once again, everybody.
Yes.
Getting festive for that holiday season, whether you celebrate Christmas or Hanukkah or I guess that's all.
Whatever.
I know.
Or if you don't celebrate a holiday. If you don't celebrate a holiday and you
celebrate
just
our
get
episode.
An extra
there you go.
free day off of work. Because everybody else is celebrating it, then congratulations and hope you have an awesome free day off of work.
And next year it's going to be on Friday, so that'll mean a 3-day weekend. You don't have to take an extra day off on Friday if you don't want to.
That's right.
That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yes.
All right. Love you, Mom.
Love you, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.